Tom Krasny is a queer, trans, neurodivergent, Glasgow-based artist and organizer who is passionate about non-oppressive ways of relating. Tom's work sits on the seam between art and activism and centers consent as a valuable orientation to collectively learn and practice new skills and tools that allow us to explore relationship to self, to others, and to the world around us with humility and curiosity. We are thrilled to welcome Tom to Sober Sex.
Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, gotta spiritual growth. Sober sex, all of this and more. Sober sex, you'll never get bored. Sober sex, all of this and more. Sober sex, we're never ever bored. Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, and mental health. Sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got a spiritual growth. Sober sex, you'll never get bored. Sober sex, all of this and more. Sober sex, you'll never get bored. Sober sex, all of this and more.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Louisa. How are you?
As if we haven't
today?
Been talking for like 5 minutes.
No, don't say that. Now we need to do that again.
Do over. Just kidding. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm like, it's kind of like a crazy spring weather in Glasgow. So it's like very erratic and moody.
Is that good or is that like not your fave?
I'm still kind of getting my head. Like I used to think that it was really fun, like having like a moody, fiery partner. But like this spring, it has been, some moments have been like super shitty. And like as a pedestrian, I didn't enjoy it.
Like this is less cool when I'm outside. Yeah. And so you mentioned that you're in Glasgow, and I wonder how you wound up there.
I came here in 2014, and I did a Master of Fine Arts course here between 2015 and 2017, and graduated in 2017, and then stayed here ever since. Which I think is quite a common experience for people who come to Glasgow for like study or work or following love or something like that, and they just stay because it's there's something about it very like it's also softer and it's also than a lot of places, and it's also relatively affordable, but it has like basically like an ever flowing fountain of cultural offerings and like activity and that sort of thing.
That's awesome. Because I remember in our cute pre-interview that you mentioned that it's not like you settled there. It was like you chose it. And I really appreciate that because I feel like I've been kind of like flung into every circumstance that I've lived except for this one, which is like I chose to move to the country. But otherwise, like it's just been kind of, the decisions have essentially been made for me. Mm. And it's really nice when people like where they are and they feel enthusiastic about it.
Yeah. And I don't know. There's also like a chemistry thing with cities, isn't there? Like sometimes it feels right and sometimes it feels like neutral and sometimes it feels bad.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and I wonder kind of what, like we touched on this a little bit prior to this conversation, but I wonder kind of what specific to Scottish culture, like you felt either like equanimity with or like friction with when you first moved. Cause I know again, like in France, it was baffling because America is kind of obsessed with France. Like we think about it really romantically and but culturally it was definitely a shock and super kind of baffling and uncomfortable when I first moved, until I had to like stop like looking people in the eye when we walked down the street or stop trying to date in like a kind of like vanilla, like hetero.
Can I ask you a question about it? Because I'm also curious. I don't think I've heard from you like about it. Is that okay?
Yeah, of course. It's a conversation. We can go back and forth.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'm curious, like, as to the difference between, like, maybe the fantasy that you had about French culture and, like, the reality of it. Like, if what resonated and what super contrasted.
I guess for me, I didn't really have a fantasy about it. I felt like the fantasy is often projected onto me by other people who are like, oh my God, you moved to Paris. Mm. And I'm just like, yeah, it wasn't a choice. Like, it was kind of a situation opened up for me here that wouldn't have been possible in the US. And I took the opportunity, but I moved here speaking no French and like was very fortunate to have people kind of open their lives to me here. But it was like kind of as kind and generous as people were when I first arrived with me, like, cause they talk about France being like a coconut culture, like it's hard on the outside and soft on the inside. And I kind of got like drilled in with a straw. Like I got direct access to the soft, sweet part, which was really special and really nice. But like, you know, in the meantime, I just felt like a stupid alien most of the time. Like I didn't understand any of the codes and like felt like the sixth sense, like no one makes eye contact while walking down the street here, which is like very different from New York, for example.
Really?
That's yeah. So you kind of like look at whoever you're intersecting, like you look at like their ear.
Oh.
It's really weird. I mean, for me, coming from a different culture. So, you know, that, those were things that were kind of frustrating and bizarre. And then I kind of like, one thing I like and had asked these questions to guests who are maybe living in places that they didn't necessarily grow up, is this idea of like, culture is assumed until you're not in it. Like I learned what being American was when I like left America. And I learned like how, like France can't see France because France is, you know, French. So yeah, you kind of have to be an outsider.
I mean, that's kind of like, I'm assuming that like here, there's a lot of immigrants that live in France and also like, you know, French can mean a lot of things. They have a lot of like kind of Arab, you know.
For sure.
Like from colonial connections, like there's a lot of, French can mean a lot of different cultures kind of in it, no?
It can, but there's also like a kind of government mandated cultural assimilation that's like really fucking racist and kind of like post-colonial, like unspoken oppression, because France loves to be like, we invented human rights. And they're very like, we are colorblind. And you're like, shut up. This is a lie. Like they're super Islamophobic and super anti-Semitic. I mean, also whatever. But I mean, like, I'm very grateful to be here because of a lot of different reasons, but I'm also like, let's not kid ourselves, you know?
There's a thing about like being a benevolent host in the sense that, for example, if you are like an organization funding art and you want to censor or have a say about what kind of subjects the art, you know, it's like this strings attached thing. And I think it's a really bad, and like true leadership is like allowing for, you know, people to be in all their cultural diversity.
Absolutely.
And I think actually to go back to your question, that's something that I really enjoy here because I'm obviously not a Scottish person and not a British person living inside this culture. And I like what you said about like discovering what American mentality is because it resonates with like my Judaism. I think it's like when you move from a place where Christianity is, let's say, like the, you know, the holidays, the public holidays are Christian holidays.
Like the baseline assumption.
Yeah. So it kind of like made me check in, first of all, like drop all the holidays like for a while, which was a relief, like 3-4 years. And then like kind of like when I felt like the need to pick them up again, to kind of find a group that I could celebrate them with in a way that didn't feel like Jewish centric and like that kind of incorporates historical lessons around liberation onto like a wider kind of and more diverse group of people.
Awesome. Yeah, that really makes sense. Like you were able to kind of reclaim them in a way that felt more aligned with your values. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. Awesome. And it was like once I got out of like, you know, there's this, what do you call this thing that makes roads that is like presses down, like a press, like a cultural
like
a, press.
Like the rolling pin attached to a heavy car.
Yeah.
Cool. I don't know what it's called.
So like once we're out of that, because like the cultural assumptions are being reinforced, you know, from everything like media, how things look, how people dress and that sort of thing. So then it's possible to start to have a choice about it and articulate it in a way that, which is also, it's really difficult. Like being an immigrant is very amazing and very difficult in this sense, because like we have an interesting perspective on things that are like assumed and we can challenge them, but also it can be sometimes lonely and uncomfortable. So I have, luckily I have, and you're asking about Scottish culture, and I think what I like about Glasgow specifically, I don't think I can attest to Scottish culture in general, but there are Scottish things I can talk about, like that it's really a really queer place and very like, nature here is like very psychedelic and very kind of like witchy and mystical, which I really enjoy. But the people that I'm surrounded by here are like a lot of them are like queer, trans, POC, like immigrants that are creatives as well. So there's a lot of intersections around like an understanding of intersectional experiences that informs our connections. And that is what part of what keeps me here, because I think if it was a very homogenous, population that I wouldn't feel as comfortable. But I live in the south side of Glasgow, which is very culturally diverse, and it's like very fiercely anti-racist and socialist as well.
Very
and
cool.
There's a lot of like queer and trans kind of presence here. There's a queer bookshop like 4 minutes from where I am. So there's a lot of feeling of community.
Awesome. And it sounds like kind of diversity but solidarity, which I think is like...
Yeah.
An important thing. And I before we get too deep, what are your pronouns?
My pronouns are he, him.
Cool. She, her. And we met through consent educator training. And I wonder kind of, you know, I know that your background is in art, but I wonder kind of what drew you to this path.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I was working with, when I did my BA in art, I went to a video department. And not to the art department, for example, because I always felt there was something more kind of grounded and applicable in also in learning a skill that can be applied to that kind of maybe is more considered like a craft than like a visual, like a fine
in terms
art.
Of video making?
Yeah.
Cool.
But also then that kind of translated into, so when I was studying in this video new media department, the thing that I was excited about that I kind of was drawn to the most was designing like props and set pieces. And then when I graduated, I kind of creating these immersive environments that are completely, it's basically like fantasy worlds that like are very immersive and they can kind of like, provide like a resting pleasurable resting space from like, you know, outside reality. And then when I graduated, I differentiation I make here is like rather than like how work in a gallery behaves, so like not that many people watch it sometimes and there's no connection between the maker of the work and the viewer of the work, whereas when I graduated I started working for in theater. I made costumes and set pieces and props for experimental visual theater and contemporary dance. And in that case, whatever I create, I can see an immediate response. So if I made like a mouse props for a Cinderella like show for kids or something, if it works, I can see it immediately. If it doesn't, I can also see it immediately. And that's like was a really useful experience for me to have. It felt like much less kind of detached. Now when I make like when I kind of create art events that I don't think about it as detached, but it's because I make an intentional effort to make these spaces like to create pockets where people can have discussions, or where we can elaborate on the work, using talks or workshops or opportunities for people to engage more deeply.
Cool.
But so it's not like coming into a room, seeing something, spending time with, which is really valuable as well, but it's not enough for me. I felt like through the years it became not enough.
Or it sounds like it's maybe, and I definitely, like, I appreciate this as like somebody whose main kind of métier is music, and like the thing is for me is live performance. Like, that's what I want to be doing all of the time. But it's like, it's not about observation, it's about connection. And if it's not, like, if there's not kind of a visceral connection, it's not, the function is somehow off.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. And also, that's very true. Like, the social element of it, and connection is a really good word for it, actually. And it's also a kind of collective meaning making. So if, for example, if we take, for example, like queer and trans communities, and we constantly live in a culture that like reinforces a compulsory, like cis heteronormativity, then like coming together in a space to kind of celebrate our culture and see it reflected, and like, you know, exchange differences and similarities in experiences, and be able to engage with it intellectually and creatively, is like really important to me.
I love that. And so I wonder kind of like where the consent piece for you is there. Cause I think I can divine it based on our shared education, but also like, I think that people who are just getting kind of clued into the path of like what consent education is might not necessarily, they might not make the connection.
No, it's a really good, it's a really good point. And also I diverted a little bit, but I think the connection for me between art and consent, for example, and what I also want to do with the consent education is kind of like to accompany people on their creative consent journeys, is that like, first of all, when we're artists, we're kind of like encouraged to, I remember when we were, when Mia Schachter, the person who led the training that both of us were on.
Friend of show, if you haven't heard the Mia Schachter episode, go listen to them. It's awesome. So, yes. Thank you for the plug.
No problem. So Mia was saying something along the lines of like, we're not like fixing a boat. We're like throwing it away and making a new boat. And I feel like when people... In fine art, we're kind of like, as we kind of study it, we are encouraged to like carve our own language and our own kind of methodology and our own aesthetic and build our own boat. So then like, it didn't make sense to me when it comes to relational practice to have to like adhere or abide by like existing scripts. Because it's like the, like this, like the, it's like, oh shit, I forgot what the Audre Lorde text is called. I have to find it one sec.
The Master's Tools House.
Oh, it's a different one.
I just start like spewing out words, like tools, uses of the erotic.
Yeah, you so the erotic, exactly. So it's like
my favorite.
Yeah. So it's like when Audre Lorde describes this like kernel that of yellow that like that colors all of the margarine, like in uses of the erotic. And it's impossible to when you know the kind of like the this like fun brain electricity of like creativity and making and forging making something, it's also like, okay, I'll talk about it in a second. Well, when you kind of like have this experience of creating something that wasn't there before, and it's also something that resonates with your preferences and your, like, you know, skills and your taste so profoundly, then it doesn't make sense to not apply this understanding to relational philosophy as well.
Mm-hmm. That's one sec. Let me just like chew on that for a sec because I really like it. That's really fascinating, actually, because I think that you just named something that, like, I almost describe as like a spiritual experience. Like I've had that, like mm-hmm. something that resonates so deeply or feels so true that it becomes impossible not to kind of flavor the rest of your existence. Yeah. That's really cool. And that's, I think what I had anticipated, let me tell you what I thought you were going to say. Yeah. Or that what your answer kind of also made me think of is like, I remember you like the kind of the opposite also being a thing, like how consent interacts with art, in this idea of that, like, I remember you talking last week about like grant applications and how you felt like you had to like round your square edges to fit into the round hole. And like, that didn't feel right. Like it felt like I wouldn't say not consent, like, but it didn't feel like it was aligned with like actually who you are and what you were trying to do or to make. And that like this kind of, when we talk about like consent wizardry or consent being a magical lens, it's like very much about, like you just said, like the whole, like the alignment is relational, if that makes sense. I feel like I'm trying to name something that's like, it is kind of magical and it like, or a little esoteric, but that like, yeah, that I'm really, fuck man. I wish I had kind of like been able to develop my, what words were coming out of my mouth before I spoke them into the universe. But does that sound right? Does that sound like the track that you were going down?
I'm not 100% sure. Like, I want you to elaborate on it a little bit. And I think also if we're going to talk about magic, then maybe we need to tell people who are listening to this kind of like what's Mia's kind of approach to magic, because it feels like, you know, it's obvious to you and me, but like it's maybe doesn't transpire necessarily. But do you want to take like a breath for a second, kind of like laser that like inside and then like go again? So I can understand it better.
Yeah, totally. When you were talking about like the spot of yellow that colors the margarine, this idea of something that kind of like a kernel of truth that starts to like essentially, to expand the metaphor, like a kernel of truth that takes over your life, you know?
Yeah. For me, it's also not like maybe a kernel of truth. It's more like a kernel of joy and like a feeling of like deep resonance, feeling of the joy that comes from like deep resonance and idiosyncratic creation.
Yes.
Or expression.
Yeah. That when you were talking about like the metaphor of like building a new boat and or kind of carving your own path within your art practice, that like that there is a lot of like similarities between these two stances, essentially, that they're like the same stance in different kind of like, one might be expressed as, in terms of like teaching people about consent, but it's actually the same thing as the thing that's being expressed in the art practice. It's just like two different expressions of the same like resonance or the same, as you say, like kernel of joy. Mm-hmm. And I still, and to kind of revert back to what you were talking about this idea of like wizardry or magic, is that we both learned consent in the context of like, that there is, at least this is my understanding of it, that at a certain point when you're working with the idea of really trusting intuition and advocating for it and starting to develop a fluency of kind of like gut, heart, brain, like the decisions are all unanimous, if that makes sense.
Everyone is consulted in the decision-making process.
Yeah, that as you said, like kind of coincidences or idiosyncratic kind of like occurrences start to become like normal. Like your life starts to kind of resonate with that level of alignment. And again, like even though that language sounds a little too much, it sounds like at the woo-woo threshold that you described earlier, but like I also find it to be true. And that for me, like to kind of loop back to the show's namesake, like for me that's what sobriety's been like, you know, once I stopped kind of destroying myself, that like to be aligned with like the will of the universe or a higher power or whatever has meant to kind of live along those lines. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm still curious as to kind of like, because now you're like the reason we're having this conversation at this time, and I would be so happy to have you on again, because I feel like there's so much more to talk about, awesome. but that like you're going to be teaching a course on consent.
Yeah.
And I wonder kind of how this stuff informs your teaching outside of the kind of like the content of what you're teaching, but like how you will be teaching, like what's your kind of approach?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Let me gather my thoughts. I think something that we experienced with Mia that I really enjoyed and I think is really important is the idea of like the person who is leading the group is not an expert on people in the group's lives. So the idea of like a pedagogy that plays a lot of emphasis on people's own agency and that the people are the experts of their own like experience is something that's really important to me, and that I'm going to be making sure to be very clear about, and also repeatedly make present during the time of the course. Another thing is kind of sensory. I don't know if this is kind of like what you mean, but it's one of the things that I've been thinking about. So like in terms of like the sensory space for us to have like a place that has like a really pleasant light, that we're going to be comfortable, that it's wheelchair accessible, and considering kind of like people's journey before they actually arrive in the room, to kind of facilitate and support as much as possible, like a regulated experience before we even enter the room. I think there is a lot of agreements that both Mia and Minacci, who taught us about decolonizing nonviolent communication, brought up that are to do with confidentiality, making sure that we don't kind of like cancel each other and we meet each other like where we're at in terms of life. If someone is not like familiar with the terminology, or if there's differences in experience between people in the group, that we all kind of like we'll be gentle with each other and move like at the slowest pace.
Mm-hmm.
In order to develop a sense of group trust, and that it's a safe kind of container to, learning is a vulnerable experience. And I think that's kind of like sacred. And I personally had like past experiences of like pedagogy that was like felt like violating and traumatic. And I never want to repeat that. Another thing that I think is really important for me is to constantly invite feedback. And I think that's another part of kind of like, yeah, it's like an important part of leadership in general, but it's just like all the time kind of making sure that people follow the material we're learning, and making sure that people have different formats if they need, or that different ways of learning are respected and the needs are met. I don't know if this is there anything that you were thinking about specifically, like an aspect that I didn't.
No, I liked your answer a lot. Like and I feel like you gave a lot of information about kind of like your priorities as a teacher. Because I know that you have like previous experience, like holding workshops and kind of creating communal spaces for learning. And I think that like, yeah, it's interesting because I feel like in starting to get into this work, my priorities might be different, but I really have like profound respect for like the level of accessibility and the level of like creativity that you want to bring into helping everybody feel a part of the thing.
Yeah. I'm curious about what are yours, but I can say definitely like emotional safety in order to like do journey of growth that is like psychological, emotional, spiritual, that could be a little bit scary. Then I think it's really important to make, it's like when you're tripping, you want to be like as comfortable as possible physically, right? So it's kind of like a condition for me for learning, because, and it's also like informed by my past experiences. So And it's together with like giving people credit like for their intelligence and their dedication and their curiosity. So my job is just to make the learning cocoon as comfortable as possible. But not, it doesn't mean that it's not challenging. It's not like kind of, you know, wrapping people in cotton balls or something. It just means that we don't need to worry about dynamic. Like, you know, it's not worrying about, like, dynamic. It's going to evolve, like, and it's not in my control, which I'm happy about. One of the things I'm really excited about group learning is that people, I can, like, make the vessel and then people pour content into it. It's, like, going to be what the group makes of it. I'm not, like, the be-all and all source of this experience.
Yeah, and I do really appreciate that. And it's, like, because everybody's experience is so different. Like, we're really talking about, like, learning how to feel in a certain way. like, and I've been thinking about this a lot, kind of, like, expanding capacities, right? Like, so much of this work, for me recently especially, has been about kind of expanding capacity for discomfort in a way that feels safe. Mm. And then, like, wondering how I can kind of hold space for others to do that.
Yeah, I saw something recently about like something really awesome about that learning to regulate is also to feel safe when we have like feelings that can feel sticky sometimes. So when we're angry, when we're activated, mm-hmm. to still feel kind of like, so it's not kind of to prevent these places on the range of like feelings, but it's just like to be okay with feeling them. Which is a pretty interesting concept.
Yeah, and I think very kind of far for me, like maybe it's starting to be kind of more of a cultural dialogue. And I think we're kind of swinging on a pendulum that's like, I grew up feeling like get your shit together. We have no time for your feelings. Like that was the message I internalized. Yeah. Maybe you too. And now like, I feel like there's kind of hyper concern about feelings. And it's like, especially in kind of recovery circles, there's this idea that like, you know, maybe when I got sober, like a long time ago, there was a lot of conversation about like feelings aren't facts. Like, mm-hmm. like you can feel something and it doesn't necessarily mean that that's like that reality is truth, which I think is helpful. And now that there's kind of now, as we're, I think, trying to create like safer spaces that feel more safe to more people, there's a new kind of strain of thought around this idea that like, if I perceive something as violence, it's violence, you know, like, and I'm also not sure if that's true. You know, I think that there's kind of a space in the middle that's about like, for me at least, has been about learning to kind of have a different self dialogue with like, oh, that feels hard. And also like, you are okay. You know,
and also like you know, maybe make some space between the what we're experiencing and the meaning that we attach to it, because a lot of the times like meaning comes later, or maybe it doesn't need to immediately be attached to what we're going through. And I think with regards to what you're saying about the different perspectives is like, I've been thinking about it in the context of like conflict navigation recently, and like it's not like a competition. One perspective is not like more important, or is it doesn't mean that like if you experience something as violent and the other side experiences it as non-violent, none of your perspectives matter more than the other one. What's important is more like talking to each other, listening, like kind of non-judgmentally to the other person and understand where they're coming from, and then it becomes more about connection than like who's right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think that
not like about it, something like everything is valid and is coming from, I think also like a lot of Marta Kaupio is a really awesome therapist and wrote a clinical toolkit for therapists who work with polyamorous people. I read a sentence that she said, like every person is a culture, or every person is like a universe. And I always respect that if there's things that I don't understand in how someone is like conducting themselves, it's probably coming from like a context that I just don't have. Mm-hmm. And listening to each other, talking about why we did something, why we have a do a something a certain way, or why we say something a certain way, it's probably informed by something that goes back.
Absolutely. Sometime.
And if I love the person, then I might like make the effort to, you know, not every person we don't have endless time to understand where everyone is coming from, but I think it's really important to lead with grace and compassion, and just like know that we don't know everything, and not jump to conclusions.
Yeah, and or take it personally, right? Yeah, that's. I think that's a really interesting kind of facet of it, that it's like it's valid, but also like, you know, I find that kind of sometimes when I sink my teeth into like my understanding of how things are and like what you meant by that, like that I can do myself a lot of harm, that it's actually not at all, like you said, like not at all intended, that it's just coming from a different context, like a frequent kind of, not frequent, but like the dynamic that becomes an issue with my partner and I is that like, I perceive him as being inconsiderate and he perceives me as being controlling. And like, they're both true, you know, but like to be aware of like, neither of those things is coming from a place of like wanting to harm the other, I think is a really valuable like island to rest on. Like, oh, that's like, this isn't, no one is trying to hurt the other person. Ever.
Yeah, like sometimes you don't recognize like the things that you maybe like grew up and you think are considerate, maybe they just like don't recognize it. But I think there's also something about like bringing things up with each other that like you need to kind of like try at least to make an effort to meet the other person like halfway.
For because sure.
Just like and even if you're doing it imperfectly, at least like just like, you know, or set a time in the week that you are doing a check-in. So you can just like vent about these things. Even if they don't change, you can just like complain about them or something, you know?
You're like, this is the window that we've set aside for complaining about each other's bullshit.
I mean, I think windows are really valuable. I had windows, for example, I was living with, after a big breakup, and I was back to living with flatmates after like a long time, not a very long time, actually. Even when I was in a relationship, like there were times where I was living with flatmates, and it was fine, but like we basically had to kind of set up a flat meeting like I don't know every 3 weeks or something, exactly for that reason, so resentment doesn't build up, so we have like kind of like times to, so we can bring up all these like strange and illogical boundaries that like everyone have and try to kind of meet somewhere in the middle to make agreements that are like that make sure that the average of everyone's needs is being met.
Yes.
Even if they're like really like seem weird to us, but we respect them nonetheless.
I mean, and I think that the kind of looping back into this idea of like consent education, so much of it is about like conflict navigation. I think that like they're in the main popular dialogue about consent is often like, as we both know, like no means no, and like don't rape people, and like or like contract based. And so to kind of expand it into like, how, like, because you disagree with something that somebody's doing, it doesn't necessarily mean that it is a consent violation, but like there's all this nuance and kind of magic in how to deal with conflict. Like, is it like saying like gratitude versus apology, right? If somebody calls you on some shit, that you, instead of being like defensive or be like, I'm sorry. And putting the onus on the other to forgive you, this idea of saying like, thank you for the feedback, I will onboard that. It's like,
but I don't know, I think like a lot of the times I think about like if someone brings something that is vulnerable with me, because I know that it's vulnerable to bring up something that's not working, or it's vulnerable to bring up something that has been hurtful, then I kind of try to look at it like as a this person who is a friend of mine, or is a lover, or is just like a co-worker or something like that, they feel safe enough to bring it up because they might be thinking that I will take it on board. And I find that to be like, that's like a trait that I value and I respect. And I want to be like a safe person for people to bring things like that up, because then it allows for more ease and more authenticity in the communication.
That's a really useful perspective, because I often kind of get a little like, I have a self-perception where I'm like, I'm trying hard to be good in relationships, and then if somebody like calls me on my shit, I get very irritated because I'm like, I'm trying so hard to be good. So I wonder what if any skills you have that kind of bring you back to that place of like, I value getting feedback, and I'm like, even if it's not necessarily something I want to hear.
If I have tools, I don't know if I have tools. I think, yeah, it's easier for me to receive feedback if I can see that the person is feeling vulnerable, like if mm-hmm. there is a vulnerable thing for them to do. It would be more challenging if the feedback is kind of delivered in a way that is like, feels like maybe it's blamey or something like that. But like, mm-hmm. I would still, if it's a person that's important for me and the relationship is important to me, I will still try to find the underlying need that the person is trying to imperfectly bring up with me. And I will try to ask clarifying questions, or if I get activated by that, then we might need to take a little break. And after we come back from the break, I try to intentionally cultivate like methods to lovingly understand what is happening for that person. Like, what am I missing out of? How are they interpreting the situation? And then I think only in that, like we were talking about before, I don't know exactly if it's answering your question, but I want to understand. My purpose is to connect, is not to like entrench and like blame and shame.
Awesome. Yeah, that's like kind of grounding in that. Sounds really very, very useful. So, you know, and like, let me know how comfortable you are with this question. It seems like it's safe, but if not, let me know. I'm curious, because one of our sober sex questions, in an effort to kind of depathologize a lot of like sexual experiences, I wonder, what were the first messages you received around sex and sexuality to kind of do a hard pivot?
Okay. What were the first messages? I think where I grew up is like, I don't know, I think North Pacific kind of culture is different in that, I don't know. I also, in warmer countries, I feel like the body has much, much more presence. Mm-hmm. And it's not like, you know, as feared or denied. But I understood that like walking around like the house, like naked, like wasn't a vibe.
I'm like, how did you understand that?
I was told by my mom. I can't even remember like what. I think like in terms of like sexuality, I don't think my like what's the name of this like polyamorous protocol? Like don't tell.
It's don't like, ask, don't tell.
Don't ask, don't tell. Yeah, my folks were like very like don't ask,
like
don't
the
tell.
American military. Okay,
which is
cool.
Like it wasn't nice. I would have rather like if my parents were like, you know, I think it's very typical of people their generation. They're like mm-hmm. kind of 65 and 73 now. That was like in the 80s and 90s, I guess, because I'm like an 80s baby. But yeah, like they basically, there was no chat, I don't think, around anything. So a lot of the, and I was like a curious person. I understood like, I understood that sexual power is a thing. Like, cause I don't know, I guess I was like an observant like person from a young age. And I understood it was a thing and that it could be like used. I think I think that it's a funny question because it's talking like on the positive side, but actually what existed like most of my teens and early 20s was like kind of like things were going on and they felt weird, like, but it was kind of like a cloud of a lot of political kind of power things that I was experiencing, but there was no language for them. But I felt a lot of incongruence, like around how I was perceiving things and how they were spoken of.
Yeah, that makes
sense. It was more of a feeling of incongruence and like a lack of vocabulary for some things, some sort of gravity pulls that felt like very, you know, repetitive and common. But I just like didn't have the roadmap to understand them. And then when I kind of like, when consent emerged, or I also like, I even like language around like needs and strategies of meeting them and boundaries and all of that, which preceded my introduction to the language of consent, felt like very enlightening in light of this kind of like weird muddy
like
fog
opacity, it sounds like. That's interesting, because it's like the first time I've kind of heard it described like that, just to kind of, because I also, you know, one thing I feel like I know about you is that there is a like high emotional, not emotional sensitivity, but like a high empathic response, I would say. And that often, based on talking to you, you kind of can feel out the vibe before often it's acknowledged, or even the people who are kind of feeling the feelings are aware of it. And I imagine that kind of that level of sensitivity combined with like incongruous messages would be really disconcerting. Just like, what's happening here?
Exactly. Neurodivergence plays into it as well, in that consent, I think, also helps because it's a orientation, and it's obviously not one orientation, but like my kind of like special flavor of neurodivergence kind of means that I need to really attune to this sensibility, and then I need to manage it. Manage sounds like a harsh word, but actually it's true. Like, because it's important for my well-being and my stability that I understand what my perceiving is like, and then I'm able to either like, you know, manage it in terms of like decisions, either to respond or not respond to it, but I can also like mediate it if needed.
Yeah. No, I mean, that definitely makes sense. And I don't know if management's a harsh word. It feels like I work a lot with animals, and like, it's very difficult to like connect if like there's kind of a hyper level of arousal or distraction, you know? So this idea of just being able to kind of like bring that down to a manageable volume makes total sense. And I know that you would like identify, you know, kind of strongly, like part of your like strength is like building and being a part of especially like queer communities. And I wonder kind of how it unfolded from the place that you kind of came from in terms of like the first messages you received around sex and sexuality into that space, that like the first messages that you received around sex and sexuality felt like they were kind of deeply incongruous. Like that there was like a lot that you were feeling that wasn't being expressed, or was like you're experiencing the expression of the opposite.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And then it kind of cut to now, which it seems like you're like trans, queer, living a polyamorous lifestyle, and like have a big part of your art and your work and your life, it seems like, in community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, that I wonder kind of what the journey was like between those two places, because they're pretty far apart.
Okay. I don't think they're far apart, because like, you know, compulsory sexuality and compulsory like cis like heteronormativity are like, it's all coming from the same place, like kind of like retaining some sort of order And until we kind of like, you know, there's a stage of like noticing the order and pointing at it and naming it in order to then like break out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think it's definitely related. And I think it's also kind of like a further departure from understanding that if we're articulating everything, and it's also like about kind of like searching and finding maybe like lineages, alternative lineages and like alternative cultures that I, that would have made much more sense to me had I discovered them like earlier on.
Okay, can you kind of speak a little bit more specifically about what, the, like, because I'm really curious about like the, like your personal history or like your experience in kind of finding a track that felt like yours.
It's a really big question, but I guess I can say, like, for example, in 2018, I started making work, like a big project that I never showed because of COVID, unfortunately, but it was kind of like a portrait of the dead Dada artist as Elsa von Freytag-Loringhoven.
Amazing. Great name, Elsa.
Elsa was like for sure like a, like kind of grew up like there are some autobiographical similarities in our experiences. She grew up in a like a kind of her in a more toxic like family of origin than mine, but there was like very strong like double standard or double morals about like her dad was doing all sorts of like adulterating and like drinking and that sort of thing. But when she was kind of like doing similar activities, she was like massively punished for them.
Mm-hmm.
And she was had a lot of like sexual appetite and curiosity, and was for sure, like power transfer was a thing in her relationships. And she was born in a town that was then in Germany, but then is now in Poland.
Mm-hmm.
And she at some point, the person she was married to committed like a giant tax fraud and had to kind of like fake his own death and like immigrate to the US.
Wow. That's not what I anticipated you saying.
And she followed him and followed him like eventually. And at some point she got to New York and she became like a very kind of like influential character in like New York Dada.
Cool.
And the people, and she was a poet as well, and the people that she got the most professional recognition from during her lifetime was like a couple of lesbian publishers that their name now evades me. I'm gonna have to like bring it up. I didn't know we were gonna talk about it today.
It's cool.
But like publishers that were publishing a literary kind of magazine called The Little Review. Wait, I need to bring it up because their names are important. Mm-hmm. Okay. So The Little Review was an American avant-garde literary magazine founded by Margaret Anderson in Chicago.
Cool.
And Jane Heap was like her partner in founding this magazine, and Elsa would basically, so these two publishers to begin with were, I was like very outraged that I wasn't introduced to them like earlier on. Like, and I was also outraged that, like, in all the history and theory kind of classes that I had during my BA, there was no, like, queer theory, for example. There was no, there was a lot of French white men.
Always.
And, And it's just like, it's really detrimental. And it's really just even not talking about experiences of like marginalized gender and sexuality, but just like in general, like the, like a queer perspective and a trans perspective on culture.
Yeah. On, I mean, even today.
Constructs, that kind of like calls out bullshit. Well, I would really benefit from like being like encountering that like earlier on.
I mean, but again, like, I don't think that I obviously that's not a unique experience, is to kind of like not necessarily get exposed to that. You know, like I read today, this morning, that 66% of stories reporting on trans people in the New York Times don't interview trans people. It's like so insane and insidious, you know, that that's somehow acceptable in 2024, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, nothing that is like, it's like nothing about us without us. Like, it's just like not okay. If you want to explore like an experience, then you need to talk to people who have
experience.
Have lived that experience, yeah.
Completely. So to kind of gently circle back to this question, like, how did you feel like you kind of found the space that you're occupying today in terms of like living within your own identity, but also like living within like community, because I think that it seems like community is really important to you.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the things that I kind of like find, a lot of the spots that I find myself is, I very intuitively move towards because they feel good or they feel kind of like resonant. I don't, it's not coming from like, it's coming from trying to be comfortable and to be stimulated in all sorts of interesting way, and not kind of not stagnate and not not stagnate and not be not stimulated. I don't know what's the word for it.
No. Uninspired.
Yeah, I just try to be like basically kind of at the edge of my learning, at the edge of my abilities, I guess, like when it comes to a lot of things in life.
Awesome. And I wonder kind of how, like, if at all, because it seems like a lot of this stuff, it seems like from observation that a lot of the consent education stuff was just maybe giving words to stuff that you were already kind of in a dance with.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, were there any like long lasting perspective shifts from like becoming a consent educator?
Mm. It's difficult to come up with. Like, do you feel like you had, maybe if I know about yours, if you had a shift, then it will inspire some thoughts about it.
It's definitely kind of given such an intense lens, especially when in terms of like media literacy, like seeing in the stories that we interact with, like how, if consent is present or not, and like in what direction, because like a lot of narrative is about that, and like how it affects kind of a morality, if that makes sense. Like, I'm thinking specifically about that movie with who's it? Colin Farrell and the donkey. I think it's called The Banshees of Inisherin. Okay. And it's like, have you seen this? I'll explain it to the listener. So it's about a guy who has a best friend, and his best friend's like an older man. They both live in a tiny, tiny town in Ireland. And the story, I think globally, is about like male depression and alcoholism. But, so his friend one day decides that like Colin Farrell's the most annoying person he's ever met. And he's like, if you ever fucking talk to me again, I will chop off my fucking hand, which is like such a violent, I mean, and then he does, spoiler alert, like every time Colin Farrell tries to talk to him, he chops off a finger and like leaves it in his house. Right. So it's, I know, so gnarly. And you're like, I can't believe this is happening. And meanwhile, Colin Farrell is just like, why don't you want to be my friend? You're my only friend. Like, so it's this kind of, it's the consent element is really confusing, you know, because it's like, who's violating who, right? Because like one person is being kind of ghosted, blanked, cut off. And the other person is like threatening that I will self-harm every time you try and ask me why, you know? And so, you know, narratives like this, I'm like, wow, that is like a, it's like a, like ball of consent yarn. Like it's kind of untangleable. The ways in which relationship kind of can see, be seen through different perspectives of like the right and wrong, not existing. Like it's much more nuanced than that, you know?
Yeah.
And then kind of in an embodied sense, I feel like it's a slower change, obviously, but it's like revolutionizing my life in that I can't do what is against my my gut or against my heart. Like I refuse. I can't be in that relationship with myself anymore. It's too damaging. Mm-hmm. And that's cool. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, I like the element of it that you can't unsee what you can't unsee it. But yeah. I feel like maybe when I had like a different relationship to it in the sense that like in media, even yesterday, like I was like in a shop and there was like a song playing in the shop and it was like, look what you've done to me, like this and this. And I'm like, there's like so much kind of like shedding of responsibility and like placing it on the other person, and like in pop yes. love songs and stuff like that. So no wonder like, yeah, we kind of need to like kind of brush the dust off of every aspect of life really. And yeah, but why I've been wanting, what's been on my mind like for throughout like our conversation is that it kind of, it's a cultivate of a sense of unknowing and being okay with it, like a comfort of like with unknowing, starting from what we were talking about before about cultural nuance, like mm-hmm. not being there to, which I think still like a lot of misinterpretations happen even when people are like from the same culture, but and I think also as we get more comfortable with being not perfect and the other people being not perfect, it just kind of like expands like the portal of like not knowing or understanding that we don't know. And yeah. also sometimes it's okay to not know. And that actually makes like, it makes much more sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I do think that kind of humility is like a spiritual tenet, you know, this idea of like, I don't know everything and it leaves room for, you know, magic or some kind of divine intervention, you know, of like,
that's not like the opposite yeah. of domination, because I think a lot of the times like trying to paint certain meaning over a situation that is like shifting and doesn't abide by this particular meaning that we're trying to like put on it. It's just, it's like, yeah, just being okay with not being in control. And I think that's also really important for relationships.
Yeah. And also, I know for me, like, so difficult.
Yeah, but it allows, like, for space to be surprised. Because, for example, if you're not, like, trying to, like, determine. And also, it doesn't work. Like, it doesn't work with me. It doesn't work with anyone. It doesn't work with you. You're not going to be enjoyed to be kind of micromanaged and told how to show up and that sort of thing. It just needs to be a choice.
Yeah.
And I think the beautiful thing about consent is also that it leads to a bigger sense of like choicefulness and choice over like, and also like sometimes we won't have like that choice, but even the awareness that we don't have a choice is like better than just like feeling in all our, it's like what you said earlier about like identifying that I'm not the feeling If we feel like we don't have a choice, but we are aware of it, only the awareness is kind of like starting a movement toward maybe shifting from that, or like maybe, yeah, thinking about ways of diverting from that.
No, I mean, but like even like just being able to, even if there's no choice in the external circumstances, like there is always the choice of like how to kind of handle it, you know, like what attitude I'm going to try and have. And I might fail, you know, like.
Another sentence I really love from Marta Kauppi that I've been kind of like holding as a light in front of me is that, is to how you want to show up in conflict. She's saying like, you know, being conflict as the person you would like the person you would like to be. So not just like being kind of like driven by your like impulses, just kind of like think about it for a sec. And do something that you would be proud of once the heat is like subsides.
That's so beautiful. Because like, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I have known people to like brag about being real assholes. Be like, and then I did this horrible, stupid thing. You're just like, wow, I'm glad I'm not the other end of your argument, you know? But there's like a level of kind of integrity that it's maybe not possible to reach, but definitely possible to kind of like lean towards.
Yeah, to aspire to. I think it's like it's a nice thing because like we're thinking about like how we're gonna be after this finishes and what we're gonna be left with, right?
Yeah.
And even if it's like in the moment where we don't get what we want, but like we don't burn the bridge by trying to at least like I don't know. What comes up to me also like when people get divorced, me included, like you kind of try, it's even though it's a really gnarly and like horrible, like, and you're swimming in this like ocean of pain, you're trying to like be civil about it. Because this person, like you and this person spent like a decent amount of time together, and you know, you don't want to become like a pile of trash when you fight.
Vindictive monster. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I don't know. I like that as a kind of like compass of like how, in fact, like it's easy to kind of behave well when you're winning, you know, like be gracious and kind of like, oh no, you shouldn't. Oh, thank you so much. You know, but like when you're disappointed or when you're not getting what you want, it's a like, then what's the attitude to kind of lean towards, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so before we descend into the lightning round, which is like the most fun part, don't worry. Okay. I wonder, will you tell our listeners about your course, who might be interested?
Yes. So I'm going to be running a 6-week evening course. It's going to be once a week on Tuesdays between 7:30 and 9:30. It's going to be at the We Retreat Studio, which is a studio in Govan Hill, close to Cross Hills train station. And it's wheelchair accessible. Yeah, what else do I need to know about? It's going to be up to 10 participants, and we're going to be kind of being introduced to terminology and the consent and boundaries framework of thinking, and also do kind of low stake exercises, either in pairs or in small groups, where we will practice kind of attuning to our boundaries and voicing them relationally with other people.
Woo! So if you are in the Glasgow area, check it out. And if people want to find you on the internet, where can they find you?
Okay, so it's steering_the_sauce on Instagram. Awesome. And I'm also working on a designated website for these things, but it still doesn't exist.
TBD. But,
yeah.
Keep checking back.
If you want to check out my art, they can go to tomkrasny.art. It's tomkrasny.art.
Beautiful. Okay, so lightning round. And I will include those links in the episode description. If you are interested, click through. Don't take notes. Nobody takes notes here. So what is your favorite snack?
Favorite snack? Maybe almonds.
Roasted, salted, dry?
Good question. I think roasted and salted is high up there.
Best choice. What is a tool that helps you focus?
Oh my God, when you said tool, I was thinking about like work hammer. Like manual tools. And I was thinking about hammer.
Hammer
is like the most to go to one. So can you ask the question again?
What's a tool that helps you focus?
Meditation.
Awesome. Any specific brand or type?
I just kind of like try to like reduce stimulation and like sit me with my eyes closed. Like, and I do it like every morning for about an hour. Sometimes I don't have enough time, so it's going to be shorter, but it's kind of like a way to check in with myself and to kind of like quiet down all incoming stimulation. So I can, so things that need to come up and I just like look at them and note them.
Very cool. What's a song that gets you pumped up?
That's a good question. I should have prepared for the lightning round.
No, the lightning round is no preparation. Preparation is forbidden.
Okay, cool. I guess, I don't know, Rosalia is like a pretty good like go-to for pumping up.
We love a pump-up song from Rosalia. I love Pizzochito.
Yeah, Pizzochito is great.
What's a way that you love to play?
I really love kind of like playing with the dressing and like expressing via clothes and fashion.
Very cool. What turns you on? And that can be either sexually or it can be like intellectually, creatively, like brings your nervous system up.
Yeah, I think vulnerability and... stimulating cultural events that are also, that feel also kind of like socially radical.
What do you love is the final question.
What do I love? What do I love? I love a lot of things. I love queer love.
Oh, I love that. So thank you so much, Tom. It's been really nice to get to know you better. And I hope that we get to do this again sometime.
Same.
Awesome. I will give you the lightning round next time. I promise.
Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, mental health, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got it, mental growth.